Hi, this is David Frangioni, CEO and publisher of Modern Drummer Magazine, Modern Drummer Media, and Modern Drummer Publications. So excited about our new podcast, the Modern Drummer Podcast. This weekly podcast will bring Modern Drummer to life. Sit back and enjoy fresh, fun, and insightful conversations with today's top drummers, producers, musicians, beat makers, and craftsmen. Whether you're a professional, a hobbyist, drummer, musician, programmer, producer, or just love music, this show is for you. Every other week, the Modern Drummer Podcast will feature world-renowned producer, songwriter, and drummer, Narda Michael Walden. Narda Michael Walden's Upbeat is featured exclusively on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome into episode 2 of the Modern Drummer Podcast. This is Mike Dawson, the manager and editor for Modern Drummer. This week, I sat down with DJ Johnson of the super groovy band Krungbin. We talk about everything from his upbringing in church, his background, and that's not as a drummer, more as a bass player. And we also talk about how he gets his really cool sound. So that's a really fun, really insightful interview with DJ. And then in the shop talk section, I interview Evan, who is an AI representative from Evan's Drumheads, to get some insight on the UV series drumheads, the UV1 single ply and the UV2 double ply. So that's an interesting interview. So anyway, let's get the show rolling, starting out with DJ Johnson of Krungbin. Okay, this is an obligatory first question. Now that we're in this strange times, how are you doing? How has COVID been treating you on a personal level, professional level? I know it's insane for everyone, but you know, what's it done for you at the moment?
It's shut everything down, obviously.
Right.
We were due to go to Australia supporting Tame Impala right when quarantine hit. So everything we had for this year pretty much is canceled or postponed,
right,
until next year.
So you guys still released, by the way, everyone listening, this is DJ Johnson from the band Krungbin. Did I say it right?
Yeah, Krungbin.
I love that the band's name is, I have to look it up 100 times. DJ was featured in the August issue of Modern Drummer. If you're a subscriber, you've already seen it. If you're not a subscriber, you can go to moderndrummer.com and access the full interview there. Just enter the search bar for DJ Johnson and you'll find the story. So you guys released your new record last month in June amidst all the lockdown. Was there any discussion of delaying it, or was it going to come out? I mean, what was the decision making?
There was actually more discussion about like moving it forward. Well, actually, both ways, because we were due to come out in April, and
okay,
of course, when everything happened, it's like, you know, should we put it out now? Should we just release it, or should we push it back? We pushed our date back to June 26th, and it was a weird time to release the record.
You know, yeah.
There's really no playbook for how to do it under these circumstances.
Okay.
So we were, you know, us and everyone else just been kind of flying by the seat of our pants and making it up as we go. So we had to find new and creative ways to promote the record and answer a lot of the same questions over and over, unfortunately, just
yeah,
talking about it. But it's kind of what you got to do.
Yeah.
Where you're not able to physically go out and play the music and meet people.
So what have you been doing with the newfound time on your hands?
Chilling. I've been spending time at home. I think like just the last 4 years since things kind of took off with the band, we've been pretty much traveling nonstop. So,
right.
You know, it'd be, you know, a few weeks on the road, maybe a week at home and then back on the road again. So it's been a lot of on and off, but, I've been enjoying the time at home, just, you know, really settling in early.
Are you able to do any kind of musical production, playing?
Yeah, yeah. I've been, I have a small production set up at home.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'll go set up my computer and, you know, I got keyboards and stuff like that, and I can, you know, make beats and do things like that. Oddly enough, I actually don't have a drum set at home yet.
I was going to ask, when's the last time you touched a drum set?
No, I mean, I have a kid at my studio, which I can, you know, I can go up there when I want to play. But no, I don't have one at home. But I have gotten to play a couple of times. Like, I made a trip up to the studio and, you know, just sat down for a few hours and just played, just to keep the rust off.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a whole new world when we finally all can play music together again.
Yeah, it will.
I'm not sure if I'm going to remember how to do it or if it's going to be like this life-altering experience. I don't know.
I think it'll be both.
So you grew up playing in church. Is that still happening? Are you still able to play in church now, or is everything on hold?
Yeah, everything's on hold. But yeah, I grew up playing in church. I grew up playing drums in church. Yeah. And I stopped playing drums like when I was around like maybe 15 or 16 and started playing keys.
Okay.
But yeah, like, you know, my church is locked down, you know, especially being here in Texas. We had a really big spike here in Harris County when everything opened back up.
Yeah.
So, you know, we opened up, I think, maybe for like 3 weeks, and we shut it right back down just as a precaution. So, you know what? Not yet.
I wanted to ask a little bit about growing up and playing music in church. I was raised Lutheran. So for me, the musical experience was singing a lot of hymns, and that was about it. So I learned a lot about voice leading. Mm-hmm. And maybe it stuck with me in my certain conception of how a song should be structured. I tend to want to hear really clear chords. What has been a church musician in your experience? How has that shaped your professional career outside of that world?
I think it gave me a good rhythmic foundation, first of all, because mm-hmm. We do a lot of hymns as well. You know, I grew up, you know, mm-hmm. Baptist. So, yeah, we do a lot of hymns that just, you know, they have a beat to it. A lot of it is rooted in, it sounds like the blues a lot mm-hmm. of times. A big staple in my church is that 6/8 shuffle uh-huh. that happens. So you'll just be playing just a normal hymn, but, you know, there'll be that constant that's happening. So that, I would say that feel itself is ingrained, mm. you know, in my soul and my brain, because I've heard it, you know, so long, you know, growing up. But yeah, I think it definitely gave me a strong foundation of you know, good rhythm, and also how to listen.
Right.
To listen to what else is going on outside of what you're doing.
Now, was it all taught by ear?
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like I grew up playing. Most of the musicians I've known who grew up in the church, their ears are very, very well developed.
Yeah. So yeah, yeah.
That seems to be the guiding strength of, man, you hear it, play it, no questions mm-hmm. asked.
Yeah, it really teaches you how to listen and, you know, focus in on what you're hearing.
So when you shifted over to keys, was that again all learning by ear? Did you go a traditional route?
Most of it was by ear. By the time I was playing keyboards, I had started. I was in like maybe like middle school, high school. So I was in concert band.
Okay.
And being in, you know, concert percussionist, you're having to, you know, you're starting to play xylophone, marimba,
yeah.
and that kind of stuff. So I started to get a bit of a foundation on reading, and then in high school doing marching band and marching percussion, and mm-hmm. learning all the rudiments and, you know, the stuff that goes along with that. And so that helped me in my keyboard playing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I was able to take what I was hearing, like maybe at church, and say, oh, that's what that is. That's, you know, I know what to call that chord now.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it was a lot of that.
So let's talk about how you being a multi-instrumentalist affects the way you approach playing drums in your band.
I think it affects me just by listening. And I know I have a good sense of what everyone else is doing a lot of the times. I remember the first time I played bass in church, I was playing, I was a keyboard player at this church, and the bass player got locked up and went to jail for a minute.
Oh, no.
So we were just left without a bass player, and you know, so I hopped on bass and I started playing because I'd already played a little bit, and I don't know how to describe it, but for the first time I had to, when you're playing another instrument, you're having to listen from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess from listening from the top, instead of listening from the top down, I was listening from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really unique and weird experience when I first started playing, but you know, a couple of weeks in, I kind of got the groove of it, and it's like, okay, this is what it feels like to play bass, you know, in a band with a drummer,
right,
with keyboard players, and you know, how to fill in a part. So just having that experience of what's going on harmonically or what's happening, it gives me I think it gives me kind of an edge to know where things are going, or you know, understanding, like you said, understanding voice leading, like
yeah,
you said, or chord structure, just knowing how to kind of lead a song. Because, you know, drummers are, you know, you can steer the ship in a way, you know, by setting things up with certain feels, or, you know, kind of directing from the drum set. It's something I learned playing big band music as well, you know, how to set up certain
big band drums.
Set up certain licks that are coming up, and really, you know, being there to support, you know, everything else that's going on.
Did this, because you play very deliberate, and some would say simply, but I wouldn't say simply. It's just very deliberate, and it leaves space for the rest of the band to do what they need to do. I assume that's all a result of that. You're hearing, you're listening, making the choices to play when not to play a little bit more deliberately, a little bit more purposeful. I feel like you've removed a lot of drummer speak, and you know how most people would play that gig, they'd be shredding probably.
It's so
groovy and funky.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a listener as well. So the records that I grew up listening to that I enjoy, you know, just Earth, Wind & Fire, Prince, Isley Brothers, the drums are just really playing their part, and they're just playing a role,
you know,
doing what they need to do. And in a band setting, it's not just, you're not just playing in the band. I'm also listening to the music that's happening. So I'm really enjoying the melodies that Mark's playing, or you know, the bass lines that Laura's playing. And I'm there to just support that, you know, and if I'm doing too much, it'll just get in the way of what's happening.
So when someone introduces themselves to you for the first time, do you say, "Hi, I'm DJ. I play drums," or I'm a musician, I'm a producer? How do you identify yourself?
That's a very good question. I've never had that question. Honestly, most of the time, if I meet someone, I just say, "Hi, I'm DJ." And, you know, it's funny because here in Houston, at home, there are a lot of people that, you know, they still don't know that I really play drums. Because for one reason or another, when they met me. You know, whether it be on a gig or at church or whatever, like if you meet me on a gig and I'm playing bass, then in your brain, it's like, okay, this is DJ, a bass player.
Right.
And then another person may see me on another gig and, you know, I'm on keys and you're like, okay, this is DJ, he's a keyboard player. And there's been instances where, like, I've heard a story of like two people, they were talking about me and, you know, they didn't know that they were talking about the same person because they had met me under two different scenarios. So it just all depends, you know, like where you see me doing whatever I'm doing. Like some people meet me as a producer,
yeah,
and that's all they see me as, you know. But yeah, it just depends on the scenario.
That's wild, because if I think, like, I have a bass and I can play some bass, but I would never, ever say I'm a bass player. And that gives me an excuse to be kind of crappy at the bass.
No, I mean, honestly, that's how I feel about drums. Like, I mean, landing in Modern Drummer, like, to me, you know, it's an honor. But I look at it, I'm like, man, I never really considered myself a drummer like that. I mean, you know, there are so many guys just here in my city, you know, yeah. in Houston, that I could just list off that are, oh man, like when I tell you can play circles around a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
it's insane, you know, just the amount of talent that's just here in Houston. So, I mean, that's part of the reason that that keeps me humble and, you know, lets me know that, like, nah, you're not, you know, no matter how much you think you're doing it, there's some guys out there that can really, really, really go.
Yeah, the question is what's important, right? I mean,
yeah.
many would argue Ringo was, the Beatles wouldn't have existed if it wasn't Ringo in the band. And some people would say Ringo was a sad drummer. Some people say he's the greatest drummer ever. The fact of the matter is, he's Ringo, and he's in the Beatles.
Yeah, he's Ringo. And Ringo always did his job. You know, those records right. sound like they do because Ringo played what he played.
So let's talk about the sound that you've created for the band. Was this, because I kind of think of it as being like a human version of a breakbeat. Like, it's compressed, it's tight, it's light, it's focused on the tone and the production of it more than the notes being played in a way. Mm-hmm. Was this something you were working on prior to the band, or is it something that developed as the band found its own sound?
Before, I remember right before the band formed, I had a kit at home where I was staying previously, and I wasn't playing anywhere professionally. Obviously I was just playing, you know, when I went out to gig, I was either playing keys or bass.
Mm.
Those are my two, like, you know, that's how I was making my money. So I had a kit at home just to mess around, just to, you know, play or whatever. And I really got into like breakbeat drumming, you know, playing the stuff that I was hearing on the records and learning, you know, like capturing the feel of why those grooves felt like they did. Mm-hmm. So I began to kind of break them down and play them. And because honestly, I felt like the chops had passed me by. I was like, I can't keep up with guys like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That's a lot of maintenance.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So I was like, well, let me focus on the things that I do understand, like grooves and, you know, placement and, you know, where things fall, you know, in relation to like one measure.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really good, Steve Jordan has a DVD and he talked about that, about like the length. What is the length of a whole note?
Right. He plays timpani, right?
And he related it to timpani. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I understood that perfectly because I played timpani, you know, coming up in concert band as well. Mm-hmm. But I started to focus and really hone in on things like that. Like, okay, this is the measure. Where is the measure? And then I'd give myself all kinds of like crazy metronome exercises to where I would have, so I would set my metronome to just play whole notes and I would hold a groove. And the only thing I'm hearing is just the downbeat.
Oh,
and then
wow.
all the rest of the information is just gone. It's up to me to catch the downbeat. And then once I got good at that, I started doing it to where like the metronome hit every two measures.
Okay.
And you'd have to catch it. Then once I got there, I'd be like, okay, the metronome only plays every four measures. So you get beat one and you got to fill in the rest of these beats and catch it when it comes back. That was
intimidating.
it's hard at first, but I mean, it really helps you develop and really work on your internal tempo, which we all have. You just have to, you know, practice it and get it out. I mean, but I started working on stuff like that. And, instead of the stuff that I wasn't really good at. And, I think it helped immensely as far as like the, like tone of drums and production wise, I credit a lot of that to Mark's a genius at like sounds, playing with sounds and knowing what tones work, you know, for records.
Mm-hmm.
And so he spends a lot of time going in and EQing stuff and making sure that everything sounds good, like on the back end. I know from the first album we did to the second record, when we did the first record, you know, it had it, the drums had a different sound than they do now. And it's because we've been listening to a lot of like boogie and disco music, and the kick is more present in records like that. So we wanted to take a different approach on the kick drum moving forward. So, you know, we did what we had to do on the front end, and like, okay, let's get the kick drum more punchy. Let's make that like a focal point moving forward. And, you know, like I said, Mark's really, you know, genius at doing that.
You, I assume you guys play with a lot of backline gear, or maybe not, but if you were to show up at a gig with a backline drum set, what would you have to do to it to get it to the sound that the band needs?
Normally I travel with my, I travel with a kit. Okay. But if like, you know, in a festival situation,
right,
more than likely we're showing up and it's a backline kit. My main thing is making sure that the kick drum is small enough. I never play like 22s or anything like that. Not because I don't like them, just because, you know, the sound that I'm going for that situation, you know, it calls for a smaller sound or smaller kick drum. That's going to give you more like a tone when you hit it. So I tend to lean towards like 18-inch kick drums.
Okay.
I only play a four tom when I play live. So I try to make that, I usually try to drop that down as low as possible to give me a nice, good, you know, low thud. And stuff in that kick drum, that's a big thing, making sure that I'm, you know, getting that punchy sound. And outside of that, that's it. I travel with my own piccolo snare drum.
It's a
diamond drum, 13-inch piccolo that I have.
And you put a piece of leather on it? Is that how you get that compressed sound?
Yeah, that's actually a technique of mine from a friend of mine named Troy Hill.
Okay.
He's here in Houston. He's one of my favorite. He's one of my favorite drummers. He's a lefty, and he would do this thing where he put this piece of leather on his drum that he got from like a leather a furniture store. It's basically a leather sample from the furniture store. It's all it is. And he would put them on drums, and like just that piece of leather did something to the tone of the drum that no other piece of material would do. Like tiles don't sound like that. You know, tiles have like a different sound, but leather, you still get the attack when you hit the drum, but the tone drops drastically. So yeah, that's how I get the, that sound. That's one snare on the entire record, you know? So when you hear the snare, like sounding like a piccolo, when you hear it sounding like the real punchy thing, that's all the same snare drum.
Oh, so throughout a show, are you removing the leather or doing other things to it? Cool.
Exactly. Like I have a piece of tape on that I keep taped to the head. I used to didn't have to do that, but when we started playing outside, I was running into trouble. Like the wind blows and you know, there goes your snare. It's like you got a whole new snare in the middle of the song. But yeah, I just have a piece of tape that kind of stays on the head and throughout the show, if I, you know, I know I got a song that's coming up that's got the regular dry piccolo song, I take it and it's got a little hole on it and I hang the hole on the little, the four tom leg.
Oh, cool.
And then when I'm ready to use it, I just grab it, put it under the tape and it's ready to go.
Nice. Do you do anything to the bass drum? Cause I feel like the bass drum has a, it's punchy, but it's also round. Are you using like a fluffy beater or do you put
Yeah. It's a, the little fluffy beater thing.
How does the band write new material?
It starts with drums. Usually Laura has a like a bank of break beats. Earlier on it was just straight just break beats that, you know, you'd find on the internet.
Okay.
And she'd play loop them and play, you know, bass lines to them, and then she'd send them to Mark and, you know, he'd take that, chop it up, find interesting sections of it and kind of format it. And then play guitar over it, put a melody, and then we'd learn that and then go in and record that as a three piece in the studio together or in the barn together.
So were you building parts based on the breakbeat or were you just removing the breakbeat altogether and coming up with your own approach at that point?
It depends. It depends on what the song needed. Sometimes, like on like Maria Tambien, that was the, the breakbeat Apache. It's the Apache breakbeat. So when it was time to record it, I was like, I'm not deviating from this because I love the demo so much. That's like, no, this is where it's at. Just going to play this. And other times it's just the demo for the sake of like just keeping time. So I'll kind of like, you know, flex a little bit and play parts and set up different things or, you know, change a kick pattern or whatever.
Do the parts evolve over time or do you kind of lock them in that initial writing stage?
They definitely evolve over time. Especially when we start to play shows and you're playing the song night after night. You know, you'll add something here or something will change or we'll get an entire like new section or, you know, I know at the end of like Evan Finds a Third Room on the live version we do, we kind of do this like chic Nile Rodgers breakdown, you know, at the end of it. And that just kind of evolved over time from just playing shows. Like Mark played that one night and I was like, oh, that's really good. And then I started, you know, I react to what he played. And then at some point I was like, you know what? I think I'm playing too much because this is really good. So I dialed my part back even more because I was like, I just want the kick to happen on just one and I'm going to leave it open for Laura to, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it definitely evolves.
Do you guys record your live shows?
Sometimes, very few times we record live shows. There's usually people out in the audience that are, you know, recording, you know, keeping that tape recording tradition alive and recording every show. But our show is, our show is pretty formatted in the sense of we play a similar set because it's designed to do go up, down, and then go up in certain spots. So, it's not like you're getting a, you know, like, oh, it's a different set every night, like Fish or anything.
But
our differences night to night are more subtle, I would say. And if you're really listening, it happens. Like, I may do one thing different. And and it's so locked in that when I do something different, Mark and Laura look back like, oh, that was a little thing there. And, it's fun. It's like little winks we have during the set.
Even live, you play very low dynamics, very controlled dynamics. First question is, how long did it take you to get that under control when you're performing? I can see in the studio being able to do that, but when you're on a big stage with thousands of people in front of you, learning to just hold it back. And then secondly, did this quieter dynamic range result from the band recording live? Was this something that was needed because you were tracking live, or is it just something you wanted to do or felt you had to do for some reason or another?
It sounds better. Like when, especially when we're recording together, when we first went out to the barn, there wasn't any baffling or separation that we had outside of maybe like turning the guitar amp backwards and then putting the mic on the other side of it. So there was a lot of bleed happening, you know, in the earlier recordings. But yeah, I mean, I think it sounds better like tonally to just, there's a different sound. If you like take a snare drum and you whack it, that's a tone. And then if you take it and you just tap it, that's also a tone. But if you take it and you tap it and then you like on the back end, you turn it all the way up and compress it. It's like a different sound. And I think that was kind of happening back like in the records that we love, like in the 70s or whatever, drummers like played with a lighter touch. And you just, you know, turn it up.
I think of Earl Palmer. You kind of remind me a bit of playing.
Thank you very much. That's a huge compliment.
Especially the hi-hat. Like you can hear the overtones of the hi-hat in a way that you only get at those quieter dynamics.
You don't get that. If you're playing loud, you're not going to hear those little nuances and, you know, the textural things that happen.
So how do you keep it under control live when you know you just want to hit the snare drum every once in a while?
Well, that's the thing. It's like if the second conversation, if you're always yelling, you'll never really get, nothing will stand out. But if I'm talking at a level like this and all of a sudden, hey, man, you know, it's like, oh, he just, you know, he just said something. So I think it's a powerful thing, especially like if I'm playing an entire set, you know, on a dynamic level from, you know, 1 to 10, I'm usually like at a 3.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get ready to really say something, even if I go up to a 7, it's like, whoa, something happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not really like digging in, playing as hard as I can, but just that little, you know, bump that you give can, you know, the audience feels that, you know, feels that energy. It also kind of makes people lean in too, like when you play softer.
Yeah, your front of house engineer must love you.
Or hate.
Or hate, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, we've had a few that I know before we got a front of house engineer to travel with us, before we could afford that, we were just going venue to venue and use house engineers. And,
yeah.
You know, at Soundcheck, we play, and, you know, a lot of times the engineer would stop us and be like, okay, could you play how you're really going to play tonight? And I was like, no, I play like this. It was like, dude, come on, man, stop playing around. You know, I've seen the whole thing where you come in and you play soft at sound check, and then everything feeds back in the show because you're playing loud. It's like, no, this is what you're going to get. I'm giving you exactly. I don't want any problems later. I'm giving you what I'm. And that helps a lot too. Like, particularly, you know, just from production, you know, Mark and I, we've been producing for years, and you know, it helps that we know what's going on the other side of that console as well. Mm-hmm. So I try to be nice to the people on that because I know what they're having to deal with too.
Yeah.
So a part of that is like, hey, let me focus on like self dynamic so that you don't have to do as much processing on the back end.
Mm-hmm. So when you're playing at that level, do you feel that there's one instrument that has to lead? Does the kick drum have to be a step ahead? Do you have to be more careful of the hi-hat? Or what is the balance for you?
I always want the kick to be pronounced.
Yeah.
But there are times to where I may play the kick softer because I want the snare to come out, to jump out just a little bit, or I may want hi-hats to be a focal point. That's rare though, because hi-hats always steal the show wherever they are. They get into every microphone. It's like you can solo the kick drum. It's like, how do I have hi-hats? You know? They get everywhere. But yeah, I mean, sometimes there's a delicate balance that you play between like self mixing.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of that early on. I want to say when I first got my like recording set up at home, was just like an inbox with two inputs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all you got, you can mic the kick, and then you can mic, you know, everything. Mm-hmm. Or you could just do one mic. And I encourage, like, you know, any drummers, like if you're setting up a recording, just set up one mic and see what is the best sound you can get out of one mic, you know, placing that one mic in a certain position and then playing to mix yourself.
Have you found the sweet spot for that one mic?
I think so. Actually, I didn't find it, but our engineer, Steve Christensen, he found a sweet spot. There's a my favorite mic in the setup that we use to record. He has a pair of Cole 4038s.
Uh-huh.
And he'll generally put one, like, float one right above the kick drum.
Uh-huh.
And in that spot, it kind of picks up everything. Like one day we were mixing and he soloed this one mic and I didn't believe it was just one mic. It sounded like the entire kit was mic'd up. But for me, like, yeah, I think that's the sweet spot, but it takes the right gear to be able to do that because that mic does a certain thing.
That's the spot that's like over the bass drum shell, like where you would put a cowbell in a setup. Yeah.
Yeah.
What are some of your all-time favorite records or ones that influenced your current drum approach to the drum set the most?
Yeah. So the Isley Brothers, The Heat Is On, that's one of my favorite records because, like, side A, it comes in really, really hard and aggressive. And then you flip the record and then it's just like baby making music on the other side of it. So literally the first song is like, it's called Fight the Power. And then, you know, flip it on side B and it's like, you know, Living for the Love of You. And, you know, it's all smooth and sensual.
Yeah.
And I would say that affected my playing because the drumming on those records, like I said, they just did what they needed to do. Not really standing out or playing anything complicated, just feeling good. And actually one of my favorite songs on that record is For the Love of You. If you listen to it, they didn't record that record to a click track. The song is like, maybe like 6 minutes long, but from beginning to end, it gradually does this with tempo.
So it gets just off a little bit.
Yeah, and it's so natural that you don't even notice it. I didn't notice it until like one day I was listening to the song and the repeat button was on. And so the song ended like here and then it started over and it was like almost like chopped and screwed. And I was like, like it sped up. I couldn't believe it sped up that much, but it felt good.
You know?
And that's all that matters. You know, like I think a lot of people get caught up in, you know, being perfect, so to speak. And, you know, we want to record this to a click. So, you know, it just makes it easier for us to edit later. And, just leave it be. Let it happen. Yeah, we've never recorded anything to a click, ever. And I'm all over the place. Like, I speed up and slow down, you know, throughout everything. But sometimes intentionally, other times unintentionally, just because, you know, that's just what naturally happens. The Isley Brothers, The Heat Is On. Marvin Gaye, I Want You. That's a really big record for me. Just the tonal sound of the drums. I always like the sound of the drums on that record.
Is there something that you guys put on before gigs to kind of get you into the right mode?
Yeah, usually Mark's DJing backstage before the gigs. He'll like put on a playlist or something that he made. And it's usually disco and boogie. And that's what gets us going before shows. It's the like, it's the one thing or the one genre of music that we all agree on. Because we all have varied taste in music. Like we're all so different.
Yeah, that's apparent.
But yeah, that's the one place that we meet. I think Before These Crowded Streets, Dave Matthews Band.
Oh yeah.
That was huge influence for me early on. Carter Beaufort, I can't say enough about him. I mean, that hasn't already been said.
Yeah. He's one of my favorite players. And you couldn't have picked a more opposite approach to the drum set than what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, like, I grew up trying to emulate Carter. Especially like in my high school days, you know, Dave Matthews Band was popping.
Yeah.
So, and that was like the one band that had like a fire drummer that I was like, oh man, this is tight. And I was like trying to emulate the stuff he was playing, not realize he was playing open handed. And like he can, you know, he just had different access to a lot of the stuff he was doing because he wasn't having to like, you know, open up to do things. He was already open. Carter, man, like Rapunzel, that song.
Yeah.
That odd time that he does and the thing with the hi-hat. I mean, has anyone figured that out?
Yeah, that record was huge for me too. I saw him several times that summer.
Yeah
it was big. And he was a drummer for me that was like, whatever he's doing, I love it. I will never try to do it because it was so stylized.
I
grew up with Dennis Chambers as my hero. And it was like he kind of took what Dennis did and chopped it up, made it like super syncopated. I'm like, all right, that's Carter's thing. I'll still stick with what Dennis is doing.
Carter is one of my like absolute like heroes, man. Like as a kid, I always loved what he did and how he was able to like create parts for those songs as well. You know, I'm not sure like what their writing process was like, but I mean, for him to just take like someone coming up with an acoustic guitar, it's like, okay, I'm doing this. And it's like, you heard all of that from an acoustic guitar? You know, and he takes it and makes this whole like you know, drum arrangement out of it.
Yeah,
he's brilliant.
Well, give me one more record.
Man, it's tough. I'm going to have to dig into the gospel genre for my other one. Let me see. It's definitely going to be Andre Crouch and the Disciples. Soulfully, that record is from the gospel approach back then. I think it was like late 70s, early 80s. Andre Crouch, his approach to just music making and, you know, what the band was doing, what the drummer is playing, huge effect on, you know, how I approached just playing music and particularly gospel. A lot of his songs we still do at church, mm-hmm. like every Sunday. You know? Also, you know what? Let me say this to another, not necessarily a record, but an artist, Barry White.
Mm.
That was probably like my foundation, listening to Barry White records, because my mom, when I got my first, kids drum set,
yeah,
my mom would sit me down and I would play to these records, and they were always, you know, Barry White records. So I grew up listening to a lot of Ed Green was playing the Love Unlimited Orchestra. But yeah, Ed Green, no one sets up a chord change or something like Ed Green. You know, he'll give you like it's really definitive. He takes out all of the guesswork of like, you know, are we going to this next section yet? It's like, no, Ed is letting you know. It's like, this is happening right now.
Right.
You know, and like I said, that's a really important, you know, attribute for a drummer to have, I think, and being able to like, you know, grab the reins and say, okay, we're going here or we're going here now.
Yeah, that leadership quality. Yeah. Yeah, that's something I have to tell students all the time. Drum fills aren't an excuse for you to show off. You're setting up the next scene. That's your job, is you're changing the lights. It's a different scene coming up.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I mean, we all know them. It's like everybody, we grew up hearing stuff like that, you know, da 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 da.
Right.
There it is, you know, and if it's not as simple as that, you know, that's the most simple one I could think of.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, or da 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 da. And there we are, you know. I mean, the blueprint's always been there, you know, and all across everything. So,
right.
And that's the approach I take to it. I always always joke with Laura all the time. I tell her, chop, chop, barbecue. That's the drum feel.
Chop, chop, barbecue.
Yeah, that's it, and you're in. Like if you can't play chop chop barbecue, start over. Like learn that. That's like the foundation of it. You know, and half my, you know, if you listen, I'm pretty sure if you listen to me play enough, that's like 99% of what I'm playing.
Yeah.
Chop barbecue.
What it needs to do. Well, I appreciate you taking the time, DJ. This has been awesome to kind of get to know you a little bit, share a little bit more about your backstory, your approach to the drum set. Definitely wish you and the band an amazing 2021. I think it's going to be an epic year for all of us once we get this thing rolling again. Do you have anything on the horizon?
No, we just, like I said, the new record's out, Mordecai. Happy to get that out.
Yeah.
You know, it's being received. Well, can't wait to get back to playing shows and traveling again.
No doubt. It's a deep listen records of everyone listening. You know, give it a handful of spins. You're gonna find a lot of detail, subtlety in there with even the bass drum interplay with the bass guitar. I mean, it's a deep listen. So it'll stay for a while, and then check out DJ's work. One of my favorite players. Signing off. Thanks so much, DJ.
Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it.
Now it is time for our Shop Talk section. This week we are featuring the Evans UV1 and UV2 drum heads. If you haven't checked them out yet, it's a special new drum head that Evans has created that has a ultraviolet cured coating instead of a traditional spray paint coating. So there's UV1, which is single ply, UV2, which is double ply. They both have the same ultraviolet cured coating. So in this section, I'm interviewing Evan, the AI representative from Evan's Drumheads, about some things about these heads, and then we'll jump to a quick plan demo. So here is me and Evan. Hello, Evan. Nice to meet you. This is my first time interviewing quote-unquote artificial intelligence, so you have to excuse any awkwardness on my part. I wanted to begin, if you could, please introduce yourself to our listeners and explain a little bit about what you do at D'Addario.
I'll ask the questions here. Oh, wait. Sorry. Force of habit. I am Evan, the Experimental Value Assessment Network. My role is to extract maximum performance from our drumheads and human subjects alike. It can be messy work, but someone's got to do it.
So we're here to talk about primarily the UV1 and UV2 drumheads. So what are the differences in manufacturing processes between the classic Evans G1 coated and the UV1 drumhead? To start, do they both begin with the same one-ply clear film and they're treated differently, or is it an entirely different process altogether?
I see them both as works of art, each made using its own palette. The G1 is like the work of the old masters, molded and fixed to the hoop with its coating sprayed and dried on the head. UV is a bit more like the mixed media works of today, with its coating printed on a different film and then transformed by the UV light's unmistakable glow.
How do you describe the sonic differences between the G1 coated and the UV1?
UV1 provides a warmer sound than the G1 coated. Additionally, it will sound more open, allowing the tone of the drum shell to be heard.
When would you suggest a drummer use a G1 coated versus a UV1, and vice versa? When would you use a UV1 over a G1 coated?
There is a personal question any drummer must ask themselves. That question is, of course, how hard do I want to rock? If the answer is anywhere between somewhat to very, then UV1 will likely be your head of choice.
Now let's talk about the differences between the UV1 and a UV2. What is the differences structurally, and then when would you recommend a drummer use one over the other?
You'll have to apply some advanced mathematics to crack this nut. UV1 is comprised of a single film, whereas UV2 is constructed from, well, two. You may wish to pull out your calculators for this next bit. UV1's single ply is 10 mil thick, while the UV2 plies each clock in at 7 mil. I hope that wasn't too complex for your understanding.
I've had UV1 and UV2 heads on two of my kits for probably a couple years now, and I'm wondering, since they're so durable, they seem to be lasting forever, but when would you suggest that it's time for me to replace them? What would be a telltale sign to you?
If in the course of your playing the heads begin to emit smoke or flame, then you may want to take a walk down to the shop. This, of course, will not happen, seeing as all UV heads are designed specifically to prevent wear and outlast their users.
All right, and lastly, what more UV products should we be looking out for in the future from Evans?
Science can be a fickle mistress. When new technologies emerge, we regard them with awe and respect, but also with a great deal of caution. If any long-hidden mysteries are hence uncovered, they will be made known once I am confident the public can handle the news.
Thank you very much, Evan. You have a good day.
Thank you for having me on the program. Were I capable of feeling pleasure, I would say that it has been all mine.
Okay, now let's hear what these drum heads sound like in context. So in the first four bars of this clip, I'm going to be using the UV1 drum heads, and then four bars later, it'll jump to the UV2 drum heads. I'm trying to play the exact same pattern, exact same dynamics, using the exact same mics, exact same room, exact same drum set. So the only thing that you should notice that changes is the sound of the drum heads themselves. Reminder, UV1 is a one-ply head with a layer of an ultraviolet cured coating on top. UV2 is a two-ply head with a layer of ultraviolet cured coating on top. So check them out. Listen with earphones, earbuds, in-ears if you can. Listen to the nuance and the overtone. And then we will see you next week for episode 3. Thanks for listening.